Morning, everyone. I now call the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bo. Representative Bo. Representative Christensen. Representative Christensen. Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Igo present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippert is.
Lippert present.
Representative Lizegard. Representative Lizegard. Representative Mecklen.
Mecklen present.
Representative Munson.
Munson present.
I believe Representative Bo just joined. Representative Bo.
Representative Bo present.
Representative Stevenson.
Present.
All right, a quorum is present.
Christensen present.
Christensen is present. Representative Akam, have you had a chance to review the minutes from February 10th, 15th, 17th, and 22nd?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair, and I move approval.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
The minutes are adopted. Members, we are in building day here in the Climate and Energy Committee, and we're going to begin with a presentation on a Better Building Code report from Elizabeth Glidden. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Glidden, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a moment as I pull up my presentation. All right. Good morning, everyone. My name is Elizabeth Glidden. I am the Deputy Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership. I'm pleased to present our report on a Better Building Code. Minnesota Housing Partnership is a 30-plus year nonprofit organization. We have three primary areas of work. We produce data-informed research. We advocate for equitable housing policy, and we also provide community development services across the United States, specific to serving rural communities and Native nations. So the report that I'm discussing today examines the impacts of an advanced building code. And as part of our report, we conducted some analysis of multifamily housing in that 4-plus-story category across the state. We incorporated interviews to deepen perspective from residents and from property owners and managers and developers. And we also provided some synthesis of existing research to develop recommendations for consideration. As we get going, I just wanted to go over a couple of terms that will be utilized in looking at information from our report. For this report, when we use this term affordable properties, we are talking about those properties or buildings that have income affordability restrictions. And usually this is due to receipt of some kind of a public subsidy or public financing. Also, when we use this term multifamily housing, we utilized a database that is called CoStar, which tracks properties with four or more units. So when we use that term, we're talking about properties with four or more units. So this is just a snapshot of some of the data that we took a look at in this report. As past discussion in the legislature focused on the commercial code, which includes 4-plus-story multifamily buildings, we wanted to take a deeper look at and understand more about these types of buildings, including their location through the state and other characteristics. So With the two charts here on the left hand, you're able to see multifamily properties with four or more stories. So this would look at that entire stock of properties throughout the state. And this particular chart looks at affordable properties and mixed. When I use that term mixed, I'm talking about a building that might have some units that are affordable with income restrictions and some units that are considered market rate. On the right-hand side, this is more of that snapshot of what's happening with new construction in the past decade, so you're able to see that. And in our report in the appendices, we have more details on all types of properties, that market rate, mixed and affordable, and by county throughout the state, so you're able to see those numbers more specifically. Just a few key facts that I will pull out. Some highlights that are combined with other known facts about zoning, cost burden, and rental properties. One item of note that we thought was that a large portion of what we consider affordable rental units throughout the state are in these larger four-plus story buildings. So that is something that affects how we look at both new construction as well as preservation. As well, when we look at just these larger rental buildings, the four plus stories, we see that a significant number, almost a third of this housing stock, is in this category that we call affordable. And when we turn to properties in greater Minnesota, outside of that five county within the metro, we see that an even greater percent of four plus story buildings are in that category that's called affordable. Through reporting that's happened recently, we know that there's been an extensive examination throughout the state of Minnesota of what land area is zoned for multifamily housing. Those areas are quite restricted. And we also know that people of color, particularly Black and Latino households, disproportionately live in the areas where that zoning is for multifamily housing. And in our report, you'll see we tried to do a little bit of a look at some community snapshots, is what we call them, where you're able to see what were the demographics and other characteristics of the area that surrounds some select four plus story buildings, just to, again, make sure we're really looking at that context. Just another definition I wanted to share with you is this term called cost burden, because it is a term often used, talked about in the Housing Committee and in other places. And this term is commonly understood to mean that your housing costs are more than 30% of your income. When you're spending more than 30% of your income, whether you're a homeowner or you're a renter, you are considered to have cost burden. And this then affects your ability to pay for other necessities, childcare, medical needs, any ways that you might be supporting the economy. And in the state of Minnesota, about one in four households are cost burdened, which is about 550,000 households in the state of Minnesota. So for this report, we took a look at this energy cost burden. Energy cost burden is a subset within that housing cost burden. And particularly significant as we are receiving reports of rising utility bills. Inflation affects utility bills, and that is a particular cost that is affecting Minnesotans throughout the state. This is a heat map that shows that energy cost burden. And again, a couple definitions. Energy cost burden is considered to occur when you're paying more than 6% on your energy bills, with severe energy cost burden when you pay more than 10% on your cost burden. And when we look at sort of that disaggregation by income throughout the state, we understand, and I see I used a undefined acronym here. ELI stands for extremely low income households. So those would be households that pay, that are at that 30% of area median income. We can see that they have even higher than a severe energy cost burden of their income paid for utility costs. So I wanted to turn to some select recommendations. I am going to highlight four select recommendations from our report and start here with a recommendation to incorporate direct and indirect benefits into analysis of impacts of advanced building code. So through our interviews with renters and with property owners and developers, we really saw that intersection of property cost and property condition. And sometimes I feel we have a tendency to silo those issues when we're discussing properties. A property condition, including the condition of new construction, can have a direct relationship to cost, and we need to also consider related cost from home or from housing, including impact on health. Another recommendation is to invest in energy-efficient, affordable multifamily homes. Minnesota has a very strong history of bipartisan support for affordable homes, including through housing infrastructure bonds and other mechanisms. And this highlights the intersection of affordable housing with advanced building code. It really encourages us to think about the intersection of these policy areas. Also of note, our interviews with developers and owners identified some properties that may need substantial renovation into the future. And there is a particular category of renovation that would be covered by building code. I believe this is when you spend more than the cost of your renovation is over 50% of the market value of that property. And so this is an area just for note for special policy focus due to the importance and cost savings of preserving properties. The next recommendation I wanted to highlight is this issue of coordination of resources, education, and expertise as we look at all the different systems that touch properties. This is something, again, a theme that we heard from both residents as well as developers and property owners. And it's really a focus on how any code is implemented. And so the quote that we have highlighted to the side here talks about the need to connect knowledge from these systems, from when you're talking about the design end to underwriting expectations to thinking about how buildings are maintained. And then the final recommendation I wanted to highlight was about business and job growth and how these present inclusion opportunities. So there's really just a lot of exciting innovation that is happening, a lot of business growth that is already happening and has the potential to happen into the future. And we need to ensure we are focusing on inclusion opportunities for Black, Indigenous, Latino, and Asian businesses and women-owned businesses as this change continues to move forward. So with that, I don't know if you want me to keep the presentation up or take it down, so I'll look for some direction from the chair. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So we have time for a few minutes of questions. I just wanted to begin by thanking you for this excellent report and for digging into these important issues. And I think when we're discussing affordable housing, energy isn't often at the tops of minds for folks, but I think you do a really compelling job of highlighting what a big issue this is for a number of low-income renters, and that energy burden is something we should be paying close attention to as well as rent burden. So really appreciate that presentation. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, Ms. Glidden, can you put your slideshow back up to slide 8? Is that possible?
Yes, I'm working on it.
Awesome.
Yes.
So while you're doing that, as I said, I want to appreciate the presentation too, because I think it is outlining a very important point, right, when we talk about low incomes and what we can do to make sure that we can support this many Minnesotans as possible. I think slide 8 really portrays a really big issue we're having right now. And I think what we're talking about today is actually putting the cart in front of the horse, because if we look at this map right here, we're seeing that, you know, we're severely energy burdened, right? Well, maybe we should be addressing the cost of rising energy prices. That was the question I was going to ask in the last committee hearing. So I guess my question really is to you, Chair Long. When are we going to have a hearing talking about rising energy prices, the fact that propane is 40% up and fuel oil and natural gas is up 30%? Because it sounds like if we address that situation in committee, maybe we could do a little better about helping out Minnesotans before we start drastically changing the building code.
Thank you for the question, Representative Igo. So we have had a hearing on energy affordability. We had weatherization as one of our very first topics of discussion. And I think as Ms. Glidden highlighted, the hearing today is also related to energy affordability, because if we have more efficient homes, then that is going to reduce people's energy prices. In the weatherization hearing, I think we heard that individuals save on average $230 a year if their home is weatherized. So that is a direct savings for individuals. Representative Igo, and then we're going to have to move on to our bills.
Well, thank you for that answer, Chair Long. But if we're talking about people that are already suffering and are cost burdened, they're not necessarily going to have the affordability to start putting in more insulation or renovating their home. So I think we need to address the fact that we need to bring energy prices back down and talk about that before we start talking about weatherization and building code changes. Thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Glidden, for the presentation, and really appreciate the work that you do over at Minnesota Housing Partnership. You mentioned a little bit about housing infrastructure bonds, and recommend that we take a look at that. Do you guys, in your report, talk deeply into the conversation of what can we possibly do right now, knowing that the state of Minnesota, you know, wants to put in some investment into, you know, housing infrastructure bonds, and so how could we proactively work on that from, you know, those recipients of state dollars?
Ms. Glidden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Lee. So in the report, we really talk about this at what I would call a high level. So within the recommendation that addresses this point, we give sort of a list of suggestions. Some of them from our own knowledge, some that were suggested by some of the interviews that we conducted. And I think that we looked at more of those specific recommendations as coming from some of the groups and the campaigns that are working on those areas. So whether it's Minnesota Housing Partnership or other organizations, housing infrastructure bonds has been that mainstay within the state of Minnesota and is a critical foundation, but there are other suggestions both within the Housing Finance and Policy Committee and within the Tax Committee that could be of assistance to these properties.
Thank you, Ms. Glidden. All right, we're going to proceed to the bills, and it happens that the two informational hearings and one bill we have up today are all authored by me, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see, it looks like the first bill that we're going to talk about is an informational hearing. So can you tell us about your bill?
Thank you so much. So this is the draft has been posted. This is BE-159. And this bill is looking at dealing with benchmarking. Energy bills, as we've heard, are the second largest cost, often for tenants and renters. Yet there's often very little transparency around this information. Building owners often may be able to also make cost-effective energy improvements to their buildings, but may lack the information on what improvements are needed and what the cost savings could be to them if they're able to make some of these improvements. So this bill's designed to solve both those problems by providing commercial and large multifamily housing tenants with better information about the energy efficiency of a potential rental they may be looking at. This can help them make an informed decision about the costs they may be incurring and can let the market help encourage better choices about these costs. The bill also requires the lowest performing buildings to audit their performance and provides grants to those buildings to help offset this cost. So these audits can provide this valuable information to achieve cost-effective energy reductions. So it doesn't require the building owners to take any particular upgrades or actions on their building, but it does provide them with that information so that they can better make determinations about how to improve their building performance. And with that, Ms. Chair, Madam Chair, we've got, I think, five testifiers. I'd love to turn it over to them.
Great, thank you. Looks like first up, we have Rabbi Zimmerman. Would you like to introduce yourself to the committee and give us your testimony, please?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I am a building owner of sorts. We are a synagogue. Our original building was built in 1927. We have had a variety of additions and renovations, but as of 2014, Temple Israel in Minneapolis, which I'm the senior rabbi of, did a major renovation and addition on our building. And we became a part of the energy benchmarking program for the city of Minneapolis. And we are very happy recipients of an audit, recommendations that we have taken into account because we saw the inefficiencies of our building, both in cooling and heating and water supply and a variety of other places. If you all are parts of houses of worship throughout the state of Minnesota, you know that the building can become the major burden of congregants and the money that is needed to support a building becomes very astronomical for the congregation. So this building benchmarking program has helped us really increase and fix many problems. So I think it's important that you all know the numbers that make us so happy. And I think I want to go to that. So we, with the help of the City of Minneapolis Green Business Cost Share Program, we have made improvements to all of our systems. $40,000 from the city program we received to fix many of our problems, $21,000 in utility company rebates we received because of us taking into the audit and the recommendation. We have saved 123 kilowatt hours for our building, 6,000 therms, and we've reduced 110,000 pounds of carbon dioxide. That is pretty amazing. And it has saved us $17,000 off our energy bills annually. And our bills are pretty much about between $70,000 and $75,000. So that is a huge percentage of savings that has happened for us. We know that benchmarking is crucial. As my COO, CFO said, it's great to be in competition with ourselves. We are constantly looking to see the numbers getting better. Not only that, but the architects that built our addition and renovation look at it almost monthly to see where our numbers are. Everybody is rooting for us getting better and better and better. And I just want to end with the fact that it has allowed much more comfort for those who come to pray, those who come at very significant moments in their lives to celebrate a new birth, to come together as a partnership in a wedding, to have to say goodbye to a loved one. And all of that comfort is crucial. Again, if you've ever been in a church, a mosque or a synagogue, in a temple, you know that people will complain about the heat and air if they are sitting in worship. That becomes one of the major issues that we have to deal with. So lower cost, higher comfort. And as Peter Drucker said, if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. So this allows us to measure it so that we can manage it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Rabbi Zimmerman. Next, we have Katie Jones with Center for Energy and the Environment. Please unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to just share my screen here. Are you able to see it now?
Excellent. Yes, we can see it. Yep.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Chair Long and members of the Energy Committee. My name is Katie Jones. I'm the Community Program and Policy Manager for the Center for Energy and Environment, and I'm testifying in support of BE 159. I've worked with the City of Minneapolis on implementing their benchmarking policy for 5 years, and I've also provided technical support for the cities of St. Paul, St. Louis Park, Edina, Bloomington, and Rochester as they've developed their benchmarking programs. So to start, I actually want us to think about, you know, the last time you were looking for a sweet snack. Two treats I enjoy are donuts and Rice Krispie treats. And of course, my taste buds are a driver for what I choose, but something that is helpful in making my decision is the nutrition label. You know, if I'm looking to cut calories or fat, I may choose the Rice Krispie treat because you could see that it's a little bit lower values there. So overall, you know, having this type of energy or having this type of information is valuable in making decisions for my health. Similarly, you know, we measure a lot of other things in our society. So when you're going to shop for an appliance, you may see this yellow energy guide label, or when you're looking to buy a car, you'll see the MPG rating on the car window. These things let you know how energy efficient that machine is. It's really simple and yet powerful information. If knowing the energy efficiency of these machines is valuable, why not the biggest and most expensive assets that we have? Buildings. While no building owner likely wants a giant yellow sticker on their building facade, the concept holds. Energy benchmarking provides a simple yet energy efficiency information that empowers building owners and managers to make decisions that are better for their bottom line. Building owners and managers also appreciate energy efficiency information, just like we heard from the rabbi, for not only managing their energy systems and budgets, but for the ability to tout good management. You may have seen signs of benchmarking in the buildings you've walked into. Have you ever noticed the blue plaques that are often in entryways touting ENERGY STAR certification? Such plaques show that the building is highly efficient and suggests good management. This is attractive to prospective tenants and buyers. And in fact, studies like I've showed here show that ENERGY STAR certified buildings garner higher occupancy rates, higher rental rates, and higher sales prices. So I'm sure you're kind of wondering, what does it take to benchmark? Simply, benchmarking brings together two silos of information that have never been brought together before: building characteristics and energy data. Building managers enter basic building information such as building size and type, along with energy consumption, into an online portal called ENERGY STAR Portfolio Manager. This is kind of what it looks like. ENERGY STAR is the most recognized and utilized benchmarking tool. Developed and managed by the EPA, ENERGY STAR Portfolio Manager has been around for more than 20 years and benchmarks over half of the commercial building space in the United States. It is used by over 30 jurisdictions in the U.S. with benchmarking policies, including 5 here in Minnesota. The combination of building characteristics and energy usage gives an easy-to-understand ENERGY STAR score, which helps managers understand the scale of opportunity for energy savings. Another good question is, for which buildings is energy benchmarking best suited? Although really any building can be benchmarked, it's most appropriate for larger buildings. Large buildings are more likely to have complex energy systems and also large energy bills. This policy sets the minimum building size requirement at 50,000 square feet, which means that a building larger than this would be included in the policy. An example building would be a large supermarket, although not like a large Target or Walmart. Those are 250,000 square feet and larger. Another example of 50,000 square feet would be a 50-unit apartment building. This is a common size threshold in other statewide benchmarking policies in the United States, and it is the size threshold used in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'll also note that Edina and St. Louis Park have lower minimum thresholds of 25,000 square feet. The last critical piece of the policy I'll comment on is transparency. After year 2 of benchmarking, it's proposed that a building would make their energy efficiency metrics publicly available. This, too, is a best practice. Think about if car companies were required to measure the miles per gallon of the vehicle, but didn't have to tell you about it. It's not very useful. Transparent building energy efficiency information is valuable for the tenants and buyers in making their decisions, and it's also valuable for current owners, as we've heard, to be able to make their changes. So the theory of benchmarking is all well and good, but at the end of the day, does it work? The data says yes. In jurisdictions that have benchmarking, they typically see a 1-3% energy use reduction annually. For building owners and managers who want to control costs, and I don't know that I've ever met one, that matters. You can see there a summary of the benefits that I've gone through here. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill today.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. And next, we have Margaret Cherney-Hendrick with Fresh Energy. Go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee and begin your testimony.
Great. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Margaret Cherney-Hendrick, and I am testifying on behalf of Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that has been working to accelerate Minnesota's transition to a clean energy economy for nearly 30 years. Buildings generate nearly 40% of annual global carbon dioxide emissions. Of these total emissions, building operations are responsible for 28% annually, which is a huge chunk. While emissions in other sectors, like power and transportation, are declining, emissions from buildings defy that trend and have been on the rise nationally and also in Minnesota. From 2005 to 2018, for example, emissions from commercial buildings in Minnesota increased by 18%, and emissions for residential buildings increased by 32%. Given that Minnesota is not currently on track to meet its greenhouse gas reduction goals, and the science tells us that we must achieve carbon neutrality economy-wide by 2050 to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, now really is the time to implement common sense, cost-effective approaches to energy conservation and greenhouse gas reduction, especially across Minnesota's building sector. Measuring and tracking energy use through benchmarking is a necessary first step. Fresh Energy supports Chair Long's energy benchmarking bill, which will establish a critical baseline for large buildings whose total floor area is 50,000 square feet or above through basic data collection of energy usage. This best practice leads directly to cost-effective energy savings and is an important foundation for improving energy efficiency, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and can have the additional benefit of improving indoor air quality. Establishing a program that focuses on large buildings first, which are known to be the largest consumers of energy and also the largest emitters of emissions, will provide a valuable and immediately useful tool in tracking Minnesota's progress towards meeting both our energy conservation and greenhouse gas reduction goals. Additionally, benchmarking provides the benefit of flagging hidden problems in an energy system. Benchmarking provides high-level building efficiency information that can flag equipment failure or unexpected operation, which are common causes of unnecessarily high operating costs. Issues like stuck variable air volume or VAV boxes and simultaneous heating and cooling are common in larger buildings. In a three-year US EPA analysis of 35,000 benchmarked buildings, benchmarking helped reduce energy consumption by an average of 2.4% annually for a total savings of 7% on energy bills after 3 years. As a scientist with years of experience on research, this finding also makes intuitive sense to me. The first step in improving anything is to understand it and measure it. We appreciate Chair Long raising this as an important tool needed to improve energy efficiency, reduce costs, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions in our built environment. Fresh Energy encourages your support for this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And next up, we have Kim Havey, Sustainability Director with the City of Minneapolis. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, committee members, staff, and guests. My name is Kim Havey. I'm the Director of Sustainability at the City of Minneapolis. Our division at the city is responsible for developing the policy for commercial and residential benchmarking and energy disclosures and assisting with the implementation of the program, working with building owners and their staff. We began benchmarking office and commercial space more than 5 years ago and added residential buildings over 50,000 square feet in 2020. In Minneapolis, we have nearly 1,000 buildings participating in benchmarking, of which there are 440 condo, apartment, and senior apartment buildings. These buildings are currently participating in the Minneapolis benchmarking program and would have no changes to what they are currently doing as a result of the passage of this statewide bill. Most of our commercial and residential buildings are managed by a relatively small number of property management firms. As a result, once these property management firms are educated and trained in on the Energy Star portfolio manager and benchmarking, compliance becomes relatively easy. We have had consistently high compliance rates in excess of 90% annually. In many cases, property management firms are already tracking energy use data, as you heard from Katie Jones, because it's considered a best practice in the real estate industry today. So more than half, as Ms. Jones said, of the buildings that are participating, we're doing this prior to being required to do so. By putting benchmarking requirements in place and providing support through audits and other incentives, We are helping make our commercial and residential building sector much more competitive. Benchmarking becomes the catalyst that can jumpstart investments that reduce energy costs, lower emissions, create more resilient buildings, and increase the competitive advantage of those buildings in our national marketplace. In Minneapolis, we support the process by providing technical support with the Energy Star portfolio manager, the audit process, and align our incentives through the Green Cost Share program to implement recommendations of the audit. As a result of this support, we have laid the groundwork with the state's largest utilities to support benchmarking. We have worked closely with Xcel Energy and CenterPoint to provide the energy use data for all buildings over 50,000 square feet to the property owner. This is information that is already available to these utility customers if they ask for it today. This means that in many cases, the information is already available and being utilized by building owners throughout the metro area. In addition, Xcel and CenterPoint have collaborated to create a joint multifamily building efficiency audit program, and last year initiated a commercial combined energy audit program that has a simple $500 copay required by the building owner. The copay is currently covered by the city of Minneapolis, so participation in the audit is free to the property owners. This is somewhat of an equity issue because in many cases, the more expensive commercial buildings are already doing this. As you've heard from Rabbi Zimmerman, many of our older buildings, which are utilized by organizations that are not in the property management business, do not have access to the same kind of information. So this is a really helpful to those buildings that may not have the funding to be able to support investments. So helping building owners improve their building efficiency and resilience and lowering energy costs is what a benchmarking bill can do throughout the state. We have seen it work well in Minneapolis and throughout the country, and I encourage you to support the bill's passage. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have one speaker left, and then we will get to questions. So hold your thought for just 1 minute, Representative Grunhagen. First, we're going to hear from Ken Rance from Sabathany Community Center.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ken Rance. I'm the interim CEO and COO of the Sabathany Community Center. That's located in the heart of South Minneapolis, just six blocks west of the murder of George Floyd. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning regarding energy benchmarking. A little background on the Sabathany Community Center. We were founded in 1966 by African-American members of the Sabathany Baptist Church. And then in 1979, the congregation petitioned the city of Minneapolis, the Minneapolis Public Schools, to purchase the Bryant Junior High School on East 38th Street for $1, and they prevailed. Now Sabathany is one of the oldest Black legacy nonprofits in the state of Minnesota, which consists of four business units: commercial real estate, where we lease office space to BIPOC small businesses and nonprofits. We have an enterprise division where we rent our auditorium and gymnasium and banquet rooms to the community. We have social programs like a community food shelf program, seniors programs, and others. And we just built a 48-unit affordable housing project for seniors 55 and up. Now, when we take a look at our building, we're talking about 188,000 square feet, and our building is 99 years old. And unfortunately, we have gas boilers, and we have two of them, Thelma and Louise, and they are in need of repair. And it costs us, as an organization, $20,000 a year in maintenance alone. So back in 2018, Sabathany went through an energy audit through the city of Minneapolis, and unfortunately, we had an Energy Star score of zero. And from there, we decided to create the Sabathany revision project, where what we did is we started looking at programs and opportunities for us to improve. So we did a lighting retrofit, and through our partnership with CE, the city of Minneapolis, we were able to have all of our lighting in our building replaced with LED lights, which will now bring an estimated cost savings of $28,000 a year, which we're very excited about. From there, we also did an engineering study. Through that came an HVAC need. We're talking about replacing our roof, a battery storage opportunity with Xcel Energy. I'm installing solar on our roof as well and a building automation system. So what has been very beneficial with benchmarking is that it helps organizations like mine become more aware of energy efficiency and exploring options for continually reducing our overall energy costs. For example, my water, gas, and electric bill for the month of January was $27,000, where in comparison to that same utility bill being only $17,000 January of 2021. Also, benchmarking is a great way to educate the BIPOC community on energy efficiency and future careers in the energy sector by using the building as an example. I think one of the biggest misnomers about the BIPOC community is that we don't care about environmental justice, equity, and education, and that's just not true. Benchmarking also helps to support Bethany's initiatives to increase workforce development in the clean energy sector through solar, geothermal, IT training programs for urban low-income and BIPOC residents. And in closing, the benchmarking also helps to create energy efficiency, which is good for the environment overall. And if I could just make one suggestion for the bill is that I think that once the audit is conducted and the Energy Star scores are given out, it'd be nice if there was language in the bill that also talked about ways in which a building could improve in the areas of and having support for project management and consultancy, technical assistance, and financial support so that the necessary renovations and modifications can be made and to increase an Energy Star score. And I think that with the support of the state, municipalities, utility companies, and clean energy related nonprofits and foundations, they can provide the assistance that smaller or low income or BIPOC organizations or buildings such as myself can have that capacity to be able to make those improvements, to be able to do what is right by the environment, but also be more energy efficient.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Ants. I appreciate it. We've got a couple of questions. I just want people to keep an eye. Let's try to be as short as we can. This is an informational only, so it'll be back when we vote on it. So Representative Grunhagen, do you have a question?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is for Representative Long. Has the Minnesota Chamber weighed in on this, or the building trades weighed in on this bill at all?
Representative Long?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for the question. I haven't heard, I don't believe, from the chamber on this bill. I don't believe they submitted a letter, but I could check. And I've been in conversation with the trades on this, and this is, as I mentioned, as Representative Aiken mentioned, an informational hearing, and so I'm hoping to get input from folks. But the goal here is to really just provide better information for building owners to be able to make those improvements to their buildings and better information for renters.
Representative Grunhagen, any follow-up?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up. My understanding, and this is for Representative Long again, under the DE3 amendment, municipalities are not allowed to amend the provisions of this, the most recent version, and they're required to adopt amendments to the previous version as required by the Department of Labor and Industry. Do they have any flexibility at all in terms of applying this if this were to become law?
Representative Long.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think you're speaking to the bill we'll get to next. So I'm happy to answer that question when we're on that bill.
Great.
Okay.
Representative Bierman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I can wait on my questions since it's informational only, but I will take a moment just to thank Ms. Glidden for the presentation on the energy burden of homes. I've seen and talked about the low income needs across the state, and I just want to highlight again her presentation and the extreme need for weatherization and the long term value of that. And I just can't resist putting in that thank you and plug. Thank you.
Thank you. And any final comments, Representative Long?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take a minute to thank our testifiers, and in particular, Rabbi Zimmerman and Mr. Rantz, for, I think, providing really powerful examples of what this bill is designed to do, which is to help provide good information, free information that we would be paying for these audits, so that building owners can make better decisions about how to improve their buildings. And I think that the financial savings that those two examples highlighted are really powerful. And I also appreciated Mr. Rance's suggestion about seeing if we could provide some technical support afterwards. So certainly we'll want to look into that. Thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Great. With that, we are going to move on to House File 831. And Representative Long, would you like to introduce your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'll move that my bill, House File 831, be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Then, did you have an author's amendment?
I do, Madam Chair. So this is a delete all amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like. It's a different, it's the same topic, but a different take on the proposal than what this committee considered last year. So I'd like to move the DE3 author's amendment.
Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay.
Nay.
I think the ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Long, can you please tell us about your bill?
Absolutely. Well, members, buildings make up 40% of Minnesota's energy use, and commercial buildings are 20% of this total. As we know, Minnesota is not on track to meet our climate goals, and many cities have also adopted climate goals, some more aggressive than the state. A large coalition of cities has sought help from the state in achieving their goals, and we've heard over the past few years different approaches that I've offered for how to achieve this, but I think this is the best approach yet. I think this one hits the mark for a way to allow cities to take modest steps towards improving their building energy efficiency while also respecting the statewide code. The American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers, or ASHRAE, updates national energy codes every 3 years. Minnesota is already required to update the codes once they come out, but the process can take several years and often involves making amendments to the underlying ASHRAE code. In the meantime, what I'm proposing, this language, would allow cities to road test, essentially, the new national building codes that are poised for later adoption at the state level. So the cities would not be freelancing or creating their codes. They would adopt whole cloth, the national standard, that will be the state standard within a couple of years. So any training done to the new standard would be useful statewide as well in short order. This is a practical way to help cities that wish to act a little bit faster than the state while still maintaining the integrity of the energy code approach. And it would also help with energy affordability, as I think was highlighted very well by Minnesota Housing Partnership's testimony. With that, I think we have four speakers who I'd like to turn it over to, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long. First up, we have Cindy Steinhauser, Deputy City Administrator for the City of Rochester. Can you please unmute yourself and introduce yourself and provide your testimony?
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Steinhauser. I'm the Deputy City Administrator for Development Services and Infrastructure in Rochester, Minnesota. It's my honor to join the committee again today to provide testimony on the Delete All Amendment to House File 831 and share the perspective from a city in Greater Minnesota and someone who works closely with our building officials and our development community. The Rochester City Council adopted legislative priorities again for the current legislative session that include Green Energy Code and State Building Code. The Council supports legislation that would enable local entities to adopt higher commercial building energy standards that would result in lower energy costs while reducing air pollution and contributions to global climate change. When we think about the built environment and reducing greenhouse gases, this is where cities truly can have some of the greatest impacts, and there's a direct correlation in helping us achieve our reduction goals. Our legislative priorities also include support for energy efficient, new affordable housing, as it will benefit struggling residents, lowering their monthly costs and removing energy cost burden of less efficient buildings being shifted to them. That is the equity side of energy efficiency. As I said last year when I testified on a similarly aimed proposal, Rochester recognizes that unless we start approaching our work differently, we won't meet our reduction goals. And this change would just be part of the equation. Making green energy code our first thought, not our last thought in development, involves tools like code changes and education. So this bill would help us work with commercial developers to ensure that they understand our energy goals and how to achieve greater efficiency and savings for their projects. Last year, you may remember an example that I shared of an apartment building where we worked with the designer to apply SB 2030 standards, and they achieved a 67% energy reduction below the current base code. This project was able to do so by using off-the-shelf items with minimal cost increase, approximately less than 0.5% of their total project budget. Conversely, the current code allows for three times less efficient building, doesn't utilize easy-to-access tools such as free energy software. We were able to require these code changes because that project involved public incentives, but right now we can't do that for every project. This bill could be a useful option for our city to aid in our move to a zero carbon community and to our larger energy and climate goals of 30% greenhouse gas reduction by 2025 and 80% by 2050 and our 100% renewable by 2030 goal. In closing, this important legislation, we believe, has a triple bottom line benefit to both residents and communities in the state of Minnesota. I thank you for your time and the opportunity to provide this testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Steinhauser. Next, we have Kate Peruschek, Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry. Please go ahead, introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kate Peruschek and I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you, Chair Long, for inviting me to testify today on behalf of House File 831. In 2019 and early 2020, the Departments of Labor and Industry and Commerce convened a stakeholder work group to consider ways to improve energy efficiency in new commercial and large multifamily construction. The work group recommended a statewide approach to energy code improvements that ensures all new commercial and large multifamily construction is net zero by 2036, reflected in House File 831 as introduced. As this committee knows and was previously discussed, Minnesota is not on track to meet its greenhouse gas reduction goals. Improving energy efficiency in commercial and multifamily buildings of four stories or greater is a key component to helping the state get back on track, as greenhouse gas emissions in the commercial building sector have increased by 15% since 2005. Adopting the latest commercial building energy code in the most timely manner will contribute to conserving energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Current law requires the department to act on each new model commercial energy code for which the U.S. Department of Energy has issued an affirmative determination of greater energy efficiency than the prior code. States have 2 years to certify that they have reviewed and updated their codes to meet or exceed the model standard. The U.S. Department of Energy found that the latest commercial energy standard is 4.7% more efficient than the prior code. As such, DLI has authority and is in the process of rulemaking to adopt the latest national commercial energy standard, as Chair Long mentioned, ASHRAE 90.1-2019. State certification is due July 28, 2023. However, DLI anticipates the rule adoption will be final in late 2022 or early 2023. We acknowledge that the rulemaking process takes time. The agency takes a methodical approach to reviewing the model codes and considering amendments that are appropriate for Minnesota. For example, to consider adoption of ASHRAE 90.1-2019, the agency formed a technical advisory group, or TAG, made up of agency and subject matter experts to review the commercial energy code and make recommendations. The TAG met 7 times over the spring and summer, received 42 code change proposals, and recommended adoption of ASHRAE 90.1-2019 with 16 modifications. Because of the delay between release of the new published edition of the model code and statewide adoption, some municipalities have expressed an interest in adopting the national standard locally while the state undergoes the adoption process. House File 831, as amended, provides this opportunity for municipalities. Once the statewide rulemaking process is complete, the statewide commercial energy code would apply in all jurisdictions. The Commerce DLI Stakeholder Work Group discussed this option
and noted a single voluntary step-ahead option would enable municipalities to meet their energy goals while minimizing complexity and maintaining predictability. The department is pleased to continue making progress on improving energy efficiency in new commercial and multifamily construction. I'm happy to respond to any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Justin Fay with Fresh Energy. Please go ahead, introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you so much, Madam Chair, and good morning to the committee. My name is Justin Fay, and I'm here on behalf of Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a Minnesota-based clean energy nonprofit working to achieve carbon neutral economies by 2050. And we appreciate the opportunity to be here today in support of House File 831 as amended. As the committee thinks about our progress on reducing Minnesota's climate emissions, it's a good idea to take stock of where our state's strategies are making progress and where we have more significant catching up to do. To that end, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency publishes a greenhouse gas emissions inventory. It's already been referenced a couple of times in today's hearing, every few years. And the most recent report, which shows data through 2018, Minnesota's electricity sector is a clear standout with a 29% reduction since 2005. And transportation emissions are declining much more slowly, but they are declining. These results might lead one to conclude that Minnesota's economy is generally on the right track with regards to addressing climate change. Unfortunately, much of our progress is being undercut by increasing emissions from other sectors, commercial buildings, residential buildings, and industry. House File 831 takes a first step towards reducing emissions specifically from commercial buildings by giving cities the ability to adopt published model code ahead of state adoption, cities can get a jump start on tackling their own emissions from the building sector. Cities that take advantage of this tool would also then be able to usefully inform the statewide code adoption process through their own learned experience. The existing process for updating statewide commercial energy code is not altered by this bill. The global scientific consensus is that our economy will need to be carbon neutral by 2050. When you consider the nature of buildings and the long lifespan that they typically experience, or at least are intended to experience, there's a lot more to do in this area. In fact, a significant majority of the buildings that will exist in Minnesota in 2050 have already been built. As we move forward, finding ways to ensure that buildings are built right the first time will help to avoid more expensive retrofits and climate reduction strategies later on, which is a win-win for everybody. House File 831 is not a panacea. It will not single-handedly solve the problem of climate change pollution, even just from the building sector. But it is a good start, and we recognize the exemplary work done by Chair Long in trying to find a consensus path forward that could work this session. Thank you for your time, and we encourage your support of the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. And our final speaker is Jamie Fitzke with Center for Energy and the Environment. Welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Akam and members of the Energy Committee. I'm Jamie Fitzke, Director of Legislative Affairs for the Center for Energy and Environment. I'm testifying in support of House File 831 as amended. First, I'd like to thank Representative Long and all who worked on the Department of Labor and Industry's Commercial New Construction Codes Working Group and the continued dialogue on this legislation over the past few sessions. Much of this conversation began taking shape back in 2019 with the interest of some Minnesota cities that would like commercial energy codes to provide a higher amount of energy savings and or allow flexibility for cities to self-select into adopting a more advanced energy savings code. Many of us who work within the energy efficiency industry support this concept. It is the most cost-effective to build an efficient structure from the start. ASHRAE 90.1, which is short for the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers, is the industry standard for commercial building energy codes in the United States. Every 3 years, ASHRAE 90.1 is analyzed, reviewed, and updated, setting the floor or minimum efficiency of a commercial building by sector, similar to minimum safety requirements for buildings. Then the Department of Energy reviews ASHRAE's findings and then within 1 year makes a determination to if there is energy savings from the previous version. By federal statute, states then have 2 years to adopt the newest ASHRAE 90.1. Minnesota's Department of Labor and Industry then brings stakeholders together to review, amend, and adopt the energy codes. At the state level, this process can often take between 12 to 24 months. House File 831, as amended, would allow cities to adopt the new ASHRAE code, once it goes into effect nationally. The advantage of this is cities can often move at a faster pace. So this gives cities who choose to adopt the newly released code an opportunity to implement those energy codes sooner. In closing, new commercial construction codes legislation has undergone a few iterations with the goal of finding as much stakeholder agreement as possible. This bill, as amended, balances various stakeholders' priorities. I thank Chair Long and stakeholders for the extensive dialogue and commitment to finding a workable path. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I hope you support this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzke. That is all of the testifiers. Looking to see if there are any member questions. I'm not seeing any. Then I guess we do, it looks like we do have one, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I got ahead of myself a little bit as far as this bill's concerned. So my question for Representative Long is, according to the DE3 amendment of the information I have, municipalities are not allowed to amend provisions of the recent version, and they are required to adopt amendments as required by the Department of Labor and Industry. Is that correct?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Grunhagen. Yes, that's correct. The goal here is not is to prevent cities from doing any freelancing. They would have to adopt the National ASHRAE Building Code, which is the one that the state is also required to adopt. And we added in a provision that any previous amendments to the last version of ASHRAE would have to be included by the city as well. So all that careful work that was outlined earlier that the Department of Labor and Industry does to adjust the ASHRAE code would be incorporated by the cities as well.
Representative Grunhagen, any follow-up?
Oh, yeah, just a quick follow-up on the bill. You know, I just want people to understand that we have over 31,000 scientists who signed a petition that CO2 is not the problem of greenhouse gases. It's methane, which is coming from our landfills, which we should be building incinerators in rural area. In fact, increased CO2 is beneficial to our planet and to ourselves. So we're barking up the wrong tree in this particular case. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Seeing no further questions, it looks like we do have an amendment. Representative Meckland, is this your amendment? Would you like to introduce it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this would be the amendment that prohibits local municipalities from banning natural gas or propane from new construction that I've brought up many, many times before. It's very prudent that we have an only above approach.
Okay, thank you, Representative.
Figure out what's best.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, continue.
Thank you. So that's what this amendment is for.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Maybe you were cutting out. I apologize. I wasn't trying to talk over you. My apologies. Any discussion on the amendment? Representative Long.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Representative Meckland, I think we've had this discussion a few times before, but cities cannot do what you are worried about here. They're not able to implement any restrictions on natural gas hookups and buildings, and my bill would not change that. So this amendment is not needed, and I would ask members to vote no.
Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
No.
The nays have it, and the amendment is not adopted. Let's see, as I look, there aren't any other amendments. Any further, any final comments about your bill, Chair Long?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. So I just want to express my gratitude for the many, many hours of discussion that has gone into this draft back to the task force that Ms. Parashek referenced, where we had stakeholders from labor, from building owners, from affordable housing, coming together and trying to figure out the best path forward for this challenge. And I really do think that this bill is our best opportunity to find common ground and help meet everybody's goals of having more efficient buildings, and allowing cities like Rochester and others to be able to achieve their local city objectives as well. So I really appreciate members hearing this proposal today and look forward to the continued discussions.
Great, and with that, Representative Long renews his motion that House File 831, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. We have next another informational hearing, and Representative Long, would you like to tell us about your bill?
Yes, thank you so much. So we had previously hoped to get to this on Electric Vehicle Day, but I think it is also fitting on Building Day. This is a bill that would try to help with the challenge of individual tenants and renters who don't necessarily have access to electric vehicle charging. We know that with the transition to electric vehicles underway, we need to make sure that buildings have enough charging infrastructure to support this transition. And according to the U.S. Department of Energy, over 80% of EV charging happens at home, but that is much easier for homeowners than it is for renters. So this bill would help both for renters and for those who are charging at work. New commercial construction buildings are built to last for decades, well into when auto manufacturers have said that they will be all electric. So we need new construction owners and those who are making major renovations to be thinking about the future and planning ahead for electric vehicle needs. So this bill would take the simple approach of asking the Department of Labor and Industry to work with stakeholders to determine what is the appropriate requirement for new construction. So it would be put to their normal process and it would be part of the stakeholder discussions and rulemaking setting that folks are familiar with as a part of the building code process of the Department of Labor and Industry. So we would let that process play out and make decisions about what would be the best standards for electric vehicle readiness in buildings. With that, I think I have one testifier.
Great, thank you. Yes, Greg Metz with the Department of Labor and Industry. If you could go ahead and introduce yourself for the committee and provide your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Greg Metz, and I'm one of the program managers for the Construction Codes and Licensing Division of the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. The department was asked by Representative Long to provide a technical review and comment on the bill draft as it may relate to the enforcement of the state building code. Our suggestions include adding a definition of parking facilities, as well as editing portions of Subdivision 16 to clarify that the scoping requirements as well as the technical criteria will occur in the building code. Scoping identifies when, where, and to what extent the statutory criteria apply, and the technical criteria discuss the specifics of how the scope will be accomplished. Since electric vehicle charging is not currently required in the national model codes that we've adopted, if passed into law, the Construction Codes Advisory Council would form a technical advisory group, or a TAG, consisting of stakeholders and technical experts to develop the specific requirements for new or remodeled buildings. All TAG discussions are also open to the public and do allow for public comment, providing opportunity for stakeholder involvement in the development of scoping and technical criteria, as well as studying the cost implications. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm available to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. It looks like that's our only testifier. So I actually do have a question, and it's for your testifier, Mr. Metz. I have a question about when you said remodeled buildings. Is this earlier in one of our presentations, I believe Ms. Glidden was talking about a percentage of a building that had to be considered remodeled for it to be part of how they were looking at it. Tell me, is that what happens here? Is it a percentage of the structure or the parking structure that needs to be remodeled in order for this to apply?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's really yet to be determined. That's part of the discussion that the technical advisory group will unpack as they develop the scoping criteria. So the state building code is intended to basically establish the floor or the basic requirements for construction. So we're looking for something that's going to be basic and uniform and able to be implemented throughout the state, and that would be a discussion under development for the technical advisory group.
Thank you, Mr. Metz. Any other questions? It looks like Representative Igo.
Hey, Madam Chair. So my question today is kind of going along the lines, you know, we're going to be probably talking about a ton of EV charging stations getting added. I mean, we constantly have to be upgrading apartments due to building codes, et cetera. So one thing I guess was just would be for Mr. Metz, do we kind of have an idea of what the fiscal year cost is going to be on this? And then once I have a cost, I do have a follow-up to that.
Mr. Metz?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. We don't have developed this. We haven't developed a scoping yet as far as the technical advisory group, and without a scoping, it's hard to put a number on the cost. That'll be part of the discussion of the technical advisory group, is identifying what the costs are in cooperation with developing what that actual scope is going to be.
Thank you, Mr. Metz. And Representative Igo?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So thank you for that. I think this goes back to how I started this committee hearing with my first question. We're again talking about something that's going to add more costs to homes when rising energy prices are the norm right now. I think we need to be talking about that. And the second question I'm going to follow up with you on when we talk about this is, you know, if we're talking about adding EV charging stations, it is known right now, and I say it in every committee, we do not have a source of critical minerals access. And we talked about environmental justice and environmental equity in the first hearing of the year. So what is the impact going to be on environments around the world and the carbon impact from mandating EV charging stations without a safe and secure pipeline critical minerals? And I think this working group needs to address this, and it's going to find really quickly that this idea and this bill idea, frankly, doesn't make any sense at all.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the question of cost, I think that's an important one, Representative Igo, and it is much more expensive to go back in after a building has been built to install these types of electrical outlets for electric vehicles. And so that's part of the goal of this bill, is to make sure that we are reducing costs for building owners and for those tenants who we know are going to be using electric vehicles. I think we heard in our from testifiers last week that basically every major manufacturer has said that they're going down the road of electric vehicles. And so if we want consumers and folks who are living in multifamily housing or driving to work to have the ability to charge those vehicles, then we need to make sure that we're thinking now about the least cost way to provide that access.
Thank you, Representative Long. Let's see, we've got a couple other questions. Representative Franzen. Whoops, I think we lost Representative Franzen. Maybe she will be back. We'll go on to Representative Liz Lagarde.
Oh, thank you,
Hold on, Representative Liz Lagarde. Representative Franzen, are you back? I lost you. You're on my screen, I guess.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Appreciate that, Madam Chair. Representative Wong, I am curious if you know how many electric vehicles are in Meeker County or Mille Lacs County or Fribourne County.
Representative Wong.
I don't, but if you know the answer, I'd love to hear.
Representative Franzen.
Yep. So in Meeker County, there are 11. Mille Lacs, 11. And then in Fribourne County, 16. And so, I mean, would small businesses have to comply there?
Representative Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Franzen. And so I think this is a good point and one of the reasons why we didn't specify what the requirements are in the bill. This is something that would be left to the working group that Mr. Metz described to think about what would be the appropriate scope and timeline and approach for requiring electric vehicle charging stations. But in terms of your question about small businesses, this is just for new commercial construction and for substantial renovation. So this is not applying to existing buildings that aren't being renovated. We're just looking at new construction and trying to get ahead of looking at what the least cost option would be. But I can assure you that the number of electric vehicles in the counties you mentioned is not going to stay static. If you look at the number of reservations for the F-150 Lightning and the excitement about a lot of the new electric vehicles that are coming out, the tide is changing, and that will change in Greater Minnesota too. And folks in Greater Minnesota are also going to want access to charging infrastructure.
Representative Franzen, did you have a follow-up?
Yes, so I'm more of a clarifying statement, Madam Chair. So you know, nobody uses in rural Minnesota, or very few use the electric vehicles because they're just impractical for our way of life up here. And so to pay, you know, to force small businesses, even through what you call renovations, you know, it's going to cost tens of thousands of dollars in order to comply. And I just don't see that as feasible, affordable, or practical. That's just my statement.
Representative Long, did you want to respond to that at all?
Yes, please. Thank you. I'm not sure where you got the tens of thousands of dollars number, Representative Franz, and as there is no requirement currently in the bill, and that's something that would be put to the technical advisory group with the opportunity for public comment. The range for electric vehicles is getting bigger and bigger. They're more fun to drive. They're less cost in terms of maintenance. And so folks in greater Minnesota are going to be using electric vehicles and already are. They're going to find that offerings like the Ford F-150 and the new Silverado that's going to be electric are probably better for a lot of their purposes. You are actually able to plug in equipment directly to your truck. Or if you've seen the commercials, you can save a wedding or have your house powered off of your electric vehicle. So there's a lot of benefits to electric vehicles that you're not able to get from internal combustion engines.
And next we have Representative Liz Lagarde. Sorry about cutting you off before, but go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I kind of agree with a lot of what many of my colleagues have said. And, it is, you never want to do unfunded mandates and things like that. It makes it very difficult. We don't want to add extra cost to small businesses. We do want to buy clean, buy fair, extract it, the minerals here and produce it. And, but when it comes to creating an infrastructure across the state of Minnesota, I don't know when, if I'm ever going to have an electric car. I don't believe that they're necessary. I think we're on the front end of that. But to Chair Long's point, it is coming. When you have major manufacturers and they're saying by 2035 they will no longer make combustion, and then next thing you know the batteries get better, everything starts to improve. I caution my colleagues that are resistant, which frankly I'm resistant, but we need to be open-minded and we need to be pragmatic. And my comment would coincide with the struggles that greater Minnesota has with broadband. And when you look at broadband, and we feel in greater Minnesota that we're left behind, and I'm fighting every single day to try to get that technology and that infrastructure across the whole state of Minnesota. If we in greater Minnesota aren't looking to the future and starting to invest or find ways to study how to make it cost feasible, whether it's little bites at a time, in 15, 20 years from now, when this is more of the norm, I don't want greater Minnesota and my district to be left behind. Whether I agree with it or not today, it is coming. And we do need to look at some sort of investment in the infrastructure so we're not faced with the same situation we are with broadband. And my colleagues in greater Minnesota know full well that it is a crisis, and we talk about equity as a state of Minnesota, and the lack of broadband, there is not equity for us. And that's why we need to have serious conversation about what this is going to look like long term, and that we're not the ones being left behind. So it's just a little bit of a caution, trying to be pragmatic. I don't agree with it necessarily right now, but I know it's coming. And I think that anybody that is practical knows that it's coming. So Representative Igo, my dear colleague, I'm with you 110%. Made right, made in Minnesota. Let's extract these minerals here in an environmentally and labor-friendly way and lead the way. but let's also don't cut off our nose despite our face moving forward when we know that this is coming long term. It's just a comment. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment, Representative Liz Lagarde. I think the comparison to broadband and the need for infrastructure is really an important one, and I want to turn it over to Representative Long to see if he has a comment.
Thank you, Chair Akam. I just want to thank Representative Liz Lagarde for the comment, and this bill would potentially even just require expanded electrical panels so that you have the option for looking at buildings coming down the road. We know that buildings last 50, 70 years. That timeline, if you look at where manufacturers are going, we know that there's going to be a lot of people who need to charge in multifamily housing or large commercial buildings. And so, you know, we should at least at a very minimum make sure that we got the we're building the buildings to the scale where they can support those electric vehicles.
Looks like we have a couple more questions. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just kind of wanted to add, you know, going on to that, there's kind of two points that that came to my mind when I was listening to Representative Liz Lagarde talk there. And I think the first one is, you know, we obviously have a housing market in the state of Minnesota that's increasing right now. I'm really worried about adding more cost to it. But at the end of the day, this is all connected to something that I think we in this committee have forgotten about a lot since I've been in the legislature, and that's the free market. You know, Chair Long made a very good point about how people are reserving electric vehicles and the need is coming, right? Well, the need's going to come, the free market's going to catch up. Just like the first small businesses created gas stations back in the turn of the 20th century, it's going to be the same thing. And that happened without business mandates. That happened with a free market that is American exceptionalism, that's capitalism. And that's going to happen here. And, you know, the need, and I'm not against electric vehicles either. I mean, I think they're going to be a great thing, but I know one thing right now. If I bought an electric truck and drove out to Red Lake to go ice fishing, I'm not getting off the lake with it. So I don't like seeing mandates that aren't there yet and aren't studied that are going to increase the cost of housing when people in my generation can't even afford to buy a house right now because they're up 30 and 40%. And then if we add on this, the other subject that I will keep driving home in this meeting, in this committee hearing until we have a conversation about it, is rising energy prices. We need to start talking about these kind of things. This is really, really important, and this is what matters to greater Minnesota. Thank you.
Representative Long, do you have a comment? No. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comment would be to Representative Long, and maybe I'll ask him a question on this. Certainly people that are building new buildings or renovating, they already have an incentive to create an opportunity to build a charger should they need one in the future. I mean, it could be as simple as just running, you know, PVC conduit that's empty out and through the slab and out to a spot where they can pick up should they need to feed wires in there later on. That's fine. They already have that ability to do that today. Perhaps a recommendation to do that or ideas on how to do that would be sufficient. But what I think that where this bill is very short-sighted is the future of electric vehicles may not include such, you know, enormous batteries, or you're perhaps forgetting that there's technology that's being developed to have a 10-minute quick charge. So there wouldn't be a need to sit and charge overnight in someone's home. The whole concept of charging at home may be drastically different. We might be moving to some kind of, you know, fuel cells or transferable batteries. But if the government gets involved in mandating certain infrastructure, then it will prohibit the development and the changes to technology, right? You're boxing this technology in and not allowing the market to move freely. And that's why I have concerns about this. I think, do you see that there are other options other than home charging or the technology for batteries or electric vehicles will be changing over the next 5 to 10 years that this may be mandating changes that will be unnecessary?
Representative Long.
Thank you for the question, Representative Munson. And your example about running cables or raceways out, you know, I think is a good one about what this might require, which is not that expensive and pretty minimal. And I think the types of questions that you're raising are just the ones that would be had in the technical advisory group about what would be appropriate and how to make sure that we are being current with technology. In terms of your specific question, I think that in the next 10 years, we're likely to get to a place where we're not charging at home, or we're doing quick charging across the state. At least that's not what I'm seeing with the current technology, or what I'm hearing from auto manufacturers. So I do think there's going to be a need for charging at buildings. And I think we heard in our hearing on electric vehicles that a lot of multi-unit housing tenants aren't able right now to purchase electric vehicles because they don't have that charging infrastructure. So I think from the free market perspective, we want consumer choice, and we want to make sure that consumers have the option to purchase electric vehicles if they want, and often they don't right now.
Okay, Madam Chair, if I could just have a quick follow-up.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Munson.
Yeah, and I need to respond to the comments about rural broadband as well. I mean, the comparison to this, I've been opposed to dumping billions of dollars into rural broadband because it's pushing technology that is 40 years old and has enormous maintenance costs by burying these cables, whereas I signed up through SpaceX to get satellite internet, and it was shipped to me. I took it out of the box, and within 15 minutes, I have 280 megabyte download speeds, and I'm not relying on the taxpayers to fund this. It is readily available. There's other technologies that the free market will deliver if government just gets out of the way. So I would use that as an example. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comment. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Long, I'm curious here. I just got to thank you for, such an interesting committee that we have been holding. And I really enjoy being on the Energy Committee because I'm learning so much. And so in my spare time, I kind of dig around and do some, learning on what's going on, how much it's going to cost. So I, right now, am just wondering, what would the cost be for a commercial building electrical panel upgrade? So let's say I have a commercial building, I want to upgrade the electrical panels. What would that run on an average?
Representative Long, do you have those statistics?
Well, thank you for the question, Representative Franz, and we enjoy having you on the Energy Committee, too. I don't think the question is probably specific enough for me to know, and I'm not an electrical engineer, so I can't answer specifically. But what I can say is that I know it is a lot cheaper to build a larger electrical panel up front with a new construction building than it is to go back and have to resize your panel. So that's part of what we're trying to do, is just make sure that we're getting ahead of that and thinking about the cheaper options for new construction buildings to allow for connection of electric vehicles that we know are coming.
Sure.
And we've got just a couple minutes. We've got just a couple minutes left. And one other question, so please.
Really quick. So if I were to do a residential upgrade, it's going to cost anywhere from $2,000 to $6,000. That's just on the residential side. So I can only imagine it's going to be extremely expensive to do for commercial renovations, new commercial, thus driving up the prices of commercial rents. And as far as the residential and putting upgrades into residential homes, if we were to do that across the U.S., it's going to cost up over $100 billion. Now, that's across the entire U.S. So I'm going to be very interested to see exactly what that cost to the residents of Minnesota if they were to upgrade their panels, as well as on the commercial side as well, to see what we're talking about for dollars there. So thank you.
And I'll just respond briefly in that I've had to do some electrical panel upgrades in my home as I've transitioned to electrical appliances and an electric vehicle. And the upgrades to my panel were about $1,500, which is still a significant amount of money, but not near the $6,000 that were being suggested.
Madam Chair, but you were also subsidized, correct? So taxpayers paid the tax. You probably got some sort of a kickback or a subsidy in order to make that happen or claim that on your taxes.
No, I did not pay for it. Representative Mecklen, do you have a question? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Long, did you want to respond?
Oh, just very briefly, I just wanted to thank Representative Franzen for making my point, which is that the new new construction, putting the electrical panels larger, is a lot cheaper than the options that you're describing, which are the retrofits of buildings, and those are expensive, and that's what we're trying to avoid. Also, just wanted to mention that we're not targeting residential single-family homes. This is only multifamily.
We are out of time. Representative Mecklen, can you be super, super quick? We'll be really quick and get out of here.
I can. I'm just going to say quickly, because both Representative Munson and Representative Lizegard have both brought up broadband. I did order Starlink as well. I went from 8 megabytes a second, or whatever they call it, to 373 by going to the satellite thing. So there is technology that can make this a lot better. And so I just wanted to point that out. I have a lot more, but we don't have time. So we'll talk soon.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Mecklen. With that, we are adjourned. Thanks, everybody.